Welcome. This is the Fly Fishing Journeys podcast with host Rob Giannino, where we have great conversation with really awesome experts from within the fly fishing community. You see, the fly fishing lifestyle is a journey, and we're glad you're on this journey with us. Check out flyfishingjourneys.com for more podcasts, and please subscribe on your favorite podcast player. Here's your host, Rob Giannino.
Eric Noguski is an author and guide from Boiling Springs, Pennsylvania. Central Pennsylvania fly fishing is something of fly fishing folklore. From chalk streams to the spring creeks, many say this area has some of the most historic and best trout fishing in the country. Rivers like the Latourte, Spring Creek, Yellow Breeches, Big Spring, and more. You can feel the history and nostalgia just setting one wading boot in the cool waters of Penn's Creek or Little Jay. In this podcast, I dive into the fishing and flies of this beautiful area with author Eric Noguski. In his book, Favorite Flies for Pennsylvania, 50 Essential Patterns from Local Experts, Eric covers the meat and potatoes of the hatches and flies for fooling local trout. The good news is, most of these patterns are great for trout fishing around the world. With some of the key patterns, he offers a look back on the designer of the pattern as well as best fishing techniques. I love how Eric pays homage to some of the fly fishing legends in this area. He's not shy at saying he and so many of today's fly fishing professionals are standing on the shoulders of greats like Vince Marinaro, Charlie Meck, Joe Humphreys, and many others. There is so much here, and this is an episode you don't want to miss. Enjoy! As our brand states, fly fishing is a journey. We've been so glad to share this journey with you. Some of you have even decided to join us on this journey as part of our fly fishing travel program. Whether it's Iceland for monster browns and Atlantic salmon, Alaska for Pacific salmon, Patagonia, the jungle, and many places around the world, we are here to help you fulfill your dream fly fishing destination experience. As part of our curated travel program, we can assist you with all the details and logistics and offer advice to help you catch your bucket list fish. As part of a hosted group or traveling on your own, we are here to help. Check out the travel section at flyfishingjourneys.com.
Eric, thanks for being on our podcast.
Thank you very much. Feel really privileged to be here.
Well, good. We want to have a nice conversation because within your expertise is entomology, is flies. You've got this great book, Favorite Flies for Pennsylvania, 50 Flies. Well, I want to talk about the backstory of the book, the backstory of yourself, your fishing, because a lot of the stuff that you're talking about here in Pennsylvania would apply all over the world. So where do you live now, Eric?
I'm in Boiling Springs, Pennsylvania, in the heart of the Cumberland Valley.
Boiling Springs. It's kind of famous. It's kind of like famous for fly fishing.
It is, and that's not lost on me. You know, I grew up fishing the Cumberland Valley, and in fact, I give a presentation called Fishing with Ghosts, and basically the thing that I always am, it's never lost on me, is who's walked the muddy banks of the Latourte before I have. A lot of innovation has come out of the Cumberland Valley, not only in fly fishing, but also fly tying, trout behavior. When you start talking about people like Vince Marinaro and Charlie Fox and Ed Schenck and people that are still here today in this room, you know, Tom Baltz, he's a modern legend in the Cumberland Valley, for sure. And I'm lucky enough to call him a friend, for sure.
So you had mentioned a couple names, and like you kind of went through a lot of great stuff there because you mentioned Latourte, you mentioned Charlie Fox, you mentioned Vince Marinaro. So let's kind of break that down. First, let's talk about Charlie Fox.
As far as if you want to think about the way I picture the sort of the forefathers of or Cumberland Valley fly fishing, there's three that come to the top, and there were certainly others besides Charlie and Vincent. But Charlie, to me, he was the conservationist. He was the, to me, and I'm biased, but I'm not biased, but it's just my opinion. He was the best writer. He was the most entertaining writer. His book, That Wonderful World of Trout, is just a joy to read. I've read it probably, 20 times? I don't know. And I go back and reread sections out of it, and it's just enjoyable. His work that he did on the Latourte, as far as trying to promote spawning habitat and just enhancing the trout population there. They had such a love for that stream, and it meant so much to them. It's just evident in their writing, in their actions, and you know, it's just an honor to actually, like I said, just even walk the same banks.
Talk about Charlie Fox's lifespan. Like, when was he popular on the Latorte?
He started back, you know, it would have been in the 60s and up through the 1980s, really. He was certainly a presence in Boiling Springs and Carlisle and on the Latorte. And really, you know, they did a lot of cool stuff from an entomological standpoint. You know, they tried to move to get green drakes introduced into the Latorte. They collected eggs from Honey Creek up in the northern, the central part of the state, and tried to bring them down and introduced them into the Latorte. And they kind of took for a year or two, but then they kind of fizzled out, and really nobody knows why. But they were always thinking outside the box, tweaking tackle, tweaking flies. You know, why is this, looking at the insects that were present, you know, he was putting 55-gallon barrels with the ends cut off of them, adding them into the substrate to provide spawning habitat and cover for the brown trout. Importing larger gravel because they were all well read in the literature and what size gravel or cobble brown trout preferred to spawn in and things like that. There was the Fly Fishers of Paris, Fly Fishers Club of Harrisburg had a group, and there were many people involved, but they would have meetings that were, it was almost like an academic meeting. They would come and people would present their research, you know, what they had experienced, what they had set out to do and what their findings were. It was a sort of a renaissance time there for fly fishing and the development of, like I said, not only fly fishing itself, but rod tapers, and because that was, you know, bamboo and rod tapers, and, you know, just the way trout behavior was going on. They would sit and just watch and photograph how the trout would feed, and depending on the time of year, what they were feeding on. And okay. It was really interesting.
Yeah, know. It sounds like a TU meeting.
Yeah.
You know, but kind of something like my old TU meetings.
Well, yeah, but almost at another level, because there were guys there who were really, you know, taking it seriously on an almost like a scientific, it was at a scientific level.
But a passion, like a life passion.
Sure, absolutely.
So then how did Vince Marinaro come into this picture?
Well, Vince was there. He was in the area. He was a lawyer in the area, bought some property on the Latorte. And again, Vince was, you know, he took it very seriously. And his big thing, like, he was a rod maker, a bamboo rod maker, created all his own rod tapers. To this day, they're phenomenal to cast if you're a bamboo person and you know about those things. Trying to get your fingers on those numbers for those rods isn't exactly easy, but, you know, the rods cast great. His fly tying, you know, he was the first one to talk about terrestrial insects as a food source for trout. I mean, think about where that's gone. I mean, how many hopper patterns are there out there today?
So Vince was one of the originators of the original hoppers?
Yeah. Well, he was the Jacid and Beetles. Ed Shank was the one with the crickets and the hoppers on the Latorte. You know, Ed, that's a good segue into Ed. You know, Ed is really the dean of the Latorte. Ed lived on the Latorte. He grew up, he trapped on the Latorte. He knew every inch of that stream. He have really cool hand-drawn maps of the Latorte from Ed that he has done, and, you know, those things are so cherished by me. And, you know, he's the one.
He's the dean.
He's the dean. He is the dean.
The big dean.
He is. You know, he's the one. Ed Shank was the one. And, you know, his flies are still relevant today. The Latorte hopper, the Shank's minnow, the old ugly, his sculpin pattern. And one of the first people to talk crest bugs. We were mentioning crest bugs a little while ago, Yona, before we started talking here. He was the first one to come up with a crest bug pattern for the Latorte.
That's very cool.
Yeah.
Well, we kind of went through the three godfathers of the Latorte and Spring Creeks in Pennsylvania.
Right.
It kind of leads me in, because we've talked a little about the Latorte here for the listeners, to the Latorte. Tell our listeners about the river, where it's located in Pennsylvania, and it's a limestone, right?
Absolutely.
So let's talk a bit about limestones.
Yeah. The Cumberland Valley has a bunch of limestone creeks, spring creeks. They're a little different than some of the other spring creeks found in Pennsylvania up around State College, Spruce Creek, Spring Creek that runs right through State College. The streams in the Cumberland Valley are more akin to the chalk streams of England and the Hampshire region of the southern England there. Very low gradient, flat water, tons of aquatic vegetation. and they're super challenging, super technical. Really, you know, if you can go there and catch a fish, you've done good. You've done really well. It's not easy fishing. Sometimes it's easier than others, but there's a constant challenge there. The water's gin clear. The fish are extremely spooky. It's all wild brown trout on the Latour, at least. The other probably main spring creek in the Cumberland Valley is Big Spring, where we have a unique population of wild rainbow trout and brook trout. But yeah, it's just really super technical, challenging fishing. Because of the aquatic vegetation on the Latour, you're kind of limited in your tactics. I feel like the...
Can't dredge a nymph very successfully.
No, it's actually kind of difficult to be a nymph fisherman on the Latour.
Because of all the greenery down the bottom, huh?
Yep. The Latour runs through, basically starts south of Carlisle, and then runs directly through the town, of city, borough, whatever it is, of Carlisle, and then empties into the creek that runs down the middle of the Cumberland Valley called the Conedogwinet Creek, which in itself is like a big spring creek. But the sections of the Latour can kind of be divided up into three sections. The upper section above Carlisle is the section that most people think about when they talk about the Latour. That's where Charlie's Meadow is. That's where Vince's Meadow is. That's where it's super flat and really spooky trout. Lots of bank vegetation, lots of in-stream vegetation. Once you get into Carlisle, the stream has been channelized. There's limestone walls that basically line the stream the whole way through town. And then it opens up again and it becomes similar to what it looks like above Carlisle, more of a meadow stream with some wooded areas right before it goes down a series of falls into the Conedogwinet Creek. So, and the lower section fishes similarly to the upper section. It's good streamer fishing. It's good water. It's a little deeper down there. Streamer opportunities are good throughout the system, but the access is probably best on the upper section above. If you have to pick a lower boundary for the upper section, Route 81 would be a good one. And then below, right below, there's a Army War College there in Carlisle. Right below the Army War College kind of starts the lower section of the Latour.
The effortless Norweis automatic fly tying bobbin is truly a marvel that automatically rewinds itself, making thread management simple, quick, and efficient. The auto bobbin automatically retracts on its own to the correct tying position, yet remains suspended from the hook when released. In addition, the automatic bobbin works perfectly with the Norweis fly tying vise and vise thread post that comes with the vise. The Norweis auto bobbin is the perfect thread management tool. Whether tying on a Norweis or on another vise brand, this bobbin will improve, simplify, and speed up your fly tying. Norweis recommends that the first time automatic bobbin purchaser buy the Norweis bobbin kit. An instructional video on the Norweis YouTube channel demonstrates the automatic bobbin. You can purchase additional spools, the Norweis automatic fly tying bobbin kit, or the spool arbor individually. Find all the details and purchase at nor-vise.com. Norweis, the most innovative fly tying system on the market.
So if somebody wanted to kind of understand what a limestone looked like, they never fished a limestone before, I would say, based on what you said, you probably just send them up to the upper section, and so that those flats, fields area, like the Vince's Field and that type of thing, and they could get an experience of what a tort looks like.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you can see the fish.
Absolutely. And they see you. And Big Spring's another good example of that. It's pretty much very pastoral. When you think of like agricultural fields and lots of cattails and watercress and other aquatic vegetation, super gin clear, sandy, small cobble on the bottom. But most of the food, the aquatic insects are... There's not a whole lot of diversity, but what's there, it's very rich, and there's a lot of them. So you're talking about scuds and crest bugs and lots of sulfurs, ephemerellids, and some lots of blue-wing olives. Those mayflies and other aquatic invertebrates that are kind of well-suited to vegetative, They like to feed on the vegetation. There's some caddisflies there too, some stoneflies. We have a good early season stonefly hatch, which is happening now. So,
what would be the best month to fish for with dry flies? What would be the best month to dry fly fish on the Latorte?
I would say the best time would be late March into the middle of April. So we have a good stonefly hatch on, and it's kind of funny because on the sunny days, this time of year, that time of year, the early spring, you're going to see stoneflies. On the cloudy, rainy days, you're going to see olives. The other unique thing, it doesn't happen a lot, but we have a year-round sulfur hatch on the Latorte.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. I'll never forget, I was probably 17 years old, and it was January 6th, and it was a sunny day. We had a thaw, and it was, you know, in the 50s, it was quite warm, and all of a sudden, there were sulfurs everywhere. And at that point, the fish were feeding on them pretty well. And it's just kind of neat to see, you know, what I always think of as a summertime or a late spring bug happening in the middle of the winter. And it doesn't always happen en masse, and there's not always a ton of them. But occasionally, during the winter, there'll be enough sulfurs to get some fish up and eating them. Oftentimes, it's a smaller fish. But, hey, it's January, and you're fishing in sulfur.
What size fly?
That's usually like a four. The males are a little smaller. They're like a 16. Females are probably a 14.
Okay, so we're not talking about a micro fly.
No,
here.
Huh.
So there's a Latorte. That's a nice little explanation of Latorte. So thanks for that, Eric.
Sure.
So you kind of talked about Latorte. You get the big spring. What makes Pennsylvania such a historic area for fly fishing?
I think it's the diversity. First of all, we've got 86,000 miles of stream, like second only to Alaska. Over, 5,000 miles or something? It's in the book. I don't remember the exact number, but over 5,000 miles of stock trout water and 12,000 miles of wild trout water. A lot of that's brook trout water, real small. First, real small, you could jump across them. But yeah, they're there, and I think it's diverse. We have those spring creeks like we already talked about. We have the little brook trout streams, mountain brook trout streams in the north central and northern tier of the state. We have tailwaters like the Upper Delaware system, the Delaware River, Clarion River, the Allegheny River. There's all these other opportunities that throughout the state that have sort of been a breeding ground for innovation and an opportunity for the evolution of fly fishing.
How do you think like a Joe Humphreys and a George Daniels kind of play into that history?
They're certainly like right now, they're such great ambassadors and teachers to the sport. You know, it shouldn't be lost on people that about land grant university like Penn State University. Even before Joe Humphreys, you know, there were people there who were teaching kids how to fly fish at college. And after Joe, George has sort of carried the baton now, and he's teaching a ton of people. He's a wonderful instructor, and you know, introducing people to the sport not only makes for better getting the instruction makes for you for a better fly angler, but it also teaches you about the resource, and instills a sense of ownership or respect for the water, the trout waters that we have here in this state, and how fortunate we are. And those guys are phenomenal at doing that.
Eric, you had mentioned the land grant. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about the land grant for the Pennsylvania?
Well,
as far as what you know.
Yeah, I don't know a whole lot about how the original land grant university system started. I believe it was agricultural based, where the federal government gave the states funding to start schools to teach agriculture.
Okay.
And out of that agriculture came conservation, because then the Dust Bowl hit, and okay, now we need to teach the farmers how to treat their soil and how to treat their water so that it would still be around.
Mm-hmm.
So that whole conservation movement started with the land grant universities. Really, they're kind of the root, may not be the direct root of the conservation movement, but because they were utilizing the land for agriculture, and all of a sudden they're losing the productivity of the land, the technology that came out of these land grant schools you know, enabled the farmer to sort of learn how to farm or change the way they farm.
Yeah.
You know, and everything that they do is directly reflected in the water that they use too. So
somehow that has transpired to what they have now is like an endowment program with Joe Humphreys, and it's been passed down now to George Daniel, George. Where they have a big endowment program to sustain the university fly fishing courses.
Yeah, exactly. And literally, they have taught literally thousands of people to fly fish, which is kind of cool.
Yeah, University of Penn State.
Yep.
Or Penn State University.
Penn State University.
The Nittany Lions.
Right.
So we had mentioned, you had talked that you have a degree or you're schooling in entomology.
Yeah, my background is in aquatic ecology and aquatic entomology academically. I picked up a fly rod at a pretty young age, and I was into the bug stuff even before that, just from, you know, I grew up in a rural area.
Where?
Outside of Hershey.
Oh, Hershey, okay.
Yeah, and I was, you know, basically allowed to run feral, and, you know, I fished. I don't have any memories that don't include fishing, really.
Wow.
You know, we had farm ponds and streams around my house, and some of them held trout, and I just was allowed to go and explore and do all that stuff as a kid, and I just wanted to know what I was looking at when I would roll a rock over in the creek or turn a log over in the woods or whatever. I just wanted to know what I was seeing.
That's interesting. So it's always like that entomology bug.
It's always been like that.
That's wild. Yeah. So that's not too far from Hershey Park, where the amusement park is.
It is.
I've been there.
It is. And Spring Creek that runs through Hershey Park is a wild brown trout
stream. See that,
Ty?
I was just talking about amusement park. Eric brought me right back to wild brown trout. That's a thing.
Wow, brown trout are awesome. They're like rats, dude. they you know, give them some cold water and some food, they'll make it.
That's the thing. You can't say brown trout, too, especially if you're going for wild brown trout. You just can't say, hey, I caught a brown trout. You say, I have to say wild brown trout.
Right.
You know, that only happens in Pennsylvania. There's not one other state where you caught a brown trout that you use the word wild in front of it.
Well, we have a pretty heavy stocking program here in the state, and there's
you have to identify that if it was a wild fish. Right,
yeah.
It's not just like one of those stock brown trout.
Right, exactly.
It's a wild brown trout.
Right, exactly.
I get it. Yeah, you know. So as a kid, you grew up, it was like playing outside and you just having a good time fishing. You had the farm ponds.
Yep. My father was a big sailor, and we had a sailboat on the Chesapeake Bay, upper on the eastern shore of Chesapeake Bay. And I don't remember sailing a whole lot. I remember being on the boat and being in the marina. I don't know what my parents were doing, but I was fishing. Like, I learned how to walk there on a sailboat. I learned how to swim in the Chesapeake Bay. I learned how to fish and and that's all I did.
It's like a summer place?
Yeah, I mean, whenever we could sail, yeah.
Okay. How long would it take you to get there door to door?
Oh, I think it was only about 2.5-3 hours.
Was that all?
Yeah, 3 hours maybe to the marina.
Okay.
I don't really remember. I was little. I was a little kid, literally. I learned how to walk there.
Stripers,
largemouth bass, because it's kind of brackish water, the upper end of the Chesapeake Bay. Striped bass, largemouth bass, carp, sunfish, whatever. Croakers, white perch.
So off to high school, and then you decided you want to go into entomology and...
Yeah, actually, yeah, and it just worked out really well. I lucked into, I was at Millersville University, and I had a guy there that I sort of clicked with. He was an entomologist, an aquatic ecology professor by the name of John Wallace. And yeah, Millersville's here close to Lancaster, and it just sort of worked out. I fell into it, and, you know, I just kind of, I don't know if it legitimized my nerdiness or what. I don't know.
So what type of career? Tell me about your career path.
I was involved at Millersville. I was involved with mosquito research as well as other aquatic insects. And then I was still guiding at the time as well. I'd started guiding. But West Nile virus hit the United States. And I was, you know, I was one of the few people around that was doing mosquito work as well as other work. I was working for the Department of Environmental Protection in their insect taxonomy lab. So I was just kind of looking at bugs all day long through a microscope. I was still guiding at the time, still fishing all the time. And then I got a job working for as a field biologist doing work like that. A lot of water quality monitoring work, use aquatic macroinvertebrates to as a measure of water quality. Certain species of insects have different tolerances to pollution, so you can get a score. You can quantify how healthy a stream is by the bugs that are there. So
super fascinating.
Doing a lot of that work.
Who's paying you? Is it a government program?
Yeah, I was working for the county. I was working for the state, then the county, Dauphin County. Yeah.
Pennsylvania.
Yep. Mm. Yeah. But still guiding and fishing at the same time. So
where were you guiding? Out of your own business or one?
Yeah, out of my own business. I've always just kind of eased into it. I had to sort of be talked into guiding because people knew I fished and said, you should guide. And I don't know, you know, kind of thing. And because I always felt like I didn't know enough. And I still feel that way to a certain extent. I mean, yeah, I can definitely take people fishing and we can do our best. And, you know, most 9 times out of 10, we're doing all right, you know.
Yeah.
One of the best things about it, like, I don't know everything, but I'll tell you what, it sure is fun trying to figure it out, man. I love it. I love going out. It's always different, you know, and that's the best part.
Career-wise, are you still into entomology, or what is your current job?
Yeah, well,
guiding,
and I still work for Dauphin County Conservation District. I'm more of an administrative role there now, getting towards the end of my career there, but a few more years, and guiding a lot, the book, starting to writing, you know, and some magazine articles, lots of speaking engagements, and doing that kind of thing. So,
very cool.
Yeah, it's been fun. Favorite
flies from Pennsylvania. This is a super interesting book here because we were talking before. It's 50 flies plus some additional kind of historic flies in the beginning. You know, looking through, it's kind of like one of those cheater boxes because you kind of have all the best stuff here. It's Hare's Air soft tackle.
Right.
Super interesting. Charlie Boy Hopper, which we had covered a little bit ago. Let me just see here because, I mean, you got the blowtorch. Is that a Devin Olsen? Yeah, that's a Devin Olsen. You tied it yourself, but it's a Devin Olsen pattern. CDC Comparadon.
Yeah.
The zebra midge. Yes, a famous zebra midge. And just lots of cool stuff that you could recommend both here in Pennsylvania and, as like we're saying, you could take this box around the world.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, one of the things I was, you know, after I talked to a lot of people about the flies for the book and tried to get, there are definitely some, you know, specific to PA or specific situational flies in there, but a lot of them are more of a platform. You know, if you think about like a pheasant tail nymph, you know, that's sort of a platform for flies like the Frenchie and the thread Frenchie.
Right.
Everything in a fly tying, most of fly tying is derivative and it builds on itself. And I tried to put flies in the book that enable, if you're not a tier, you can take those flies and go fishing pretty much anywhere in PA. And at certain times of the year, you can be successful, you know. But the other, there's some little intricacies, like for Tom Baltz's paranymph, for example. There's some really cool things about that fly that maybe people don't realize. The thing about, one of the great things about Tom Baltz is he's a fly fishing guy. He's a phenomenal fly tyer. But he's also a fly fishing guy. He knows what it takes to have a successful day with a client. A lot of times, like dry fly fishing, people can't see the fly. So with the paranymph, for example, he ties them with an orange post. He ties them with a yellow post. He ties them with a black post. And there's a reason for that. The lighting conditions change the way you can see a fly on the water. The orange is for a bright, sunny day, normal conditions. Yellow is for, like, say you're fishing a shady stream where you're going from bright underneath some vegetation where it turns dark. That yellow shows up perfectly. The evening hours, that yellow is perfect. But say you have a gray, flat, really glare-filled day, that black wing post enables that angler to see that fly. And things like that make a fly like that super special. And maybe not everybody thinks about that kind of thing.
Super guy and super fly. That one has bailed me out more times than one. I'd be stuck somewhere, can't get a fish to take anything, and put on a paranymph, and boom.
Boom, there it is.
Yeah, yeah. And I just love how it kind of sits in that film.
Yep.
That's where you get that nymph section of the parachute or the paranymph. I love that. So it's just a fun, it looks like a super fun book and a Stackpole. So I think when you get that Stackpole book, you get a quality cover, you get that nice glossy paper that's easy to hold, fun to hold, and the graphic design work on all the Stackpole books these days are just spectacular.
Yeah, that was one of the really fun parts of the book is doing the photography. I mean, there are flies from other people, but I tied some of the flies, a lot of the flies in the book, and you know, doing the photography book was a lot of fun. Huge shout out to Jay Nichols. You know, he shortened that learning curve really, really quick. Probably, I don't remember what I wrote about him, most of them, but the photography part is something that I'm probably most proud of in the book.
You know, that's super nice stuff. Have you been a photographer for a while?
No, or? I didn't know I was one.
But you're happy with it, and it does look great.
Yeah, it worked out.
What type of camera did you use?
Just a Nikon. You know, it's all about the glass, too. I have an older Nikon macro lens that, you know, the glass on that thing is really nice. It's a pretty simple setup, but it turned out pretty well.
Tell me about the roamer.
Jake, my buddy Jake Vilwak, he's a really good friend of mine. He and I guide together. You know, we spend time together. Roamer's cool. Jake tried to, I guess the story goes that Jake was, I'm not sure if you're familiar with a fluke, like the rubber bait, the fluke.
Yep.
Like, I don't really know anything about him. He was fishing with his dad. He's from the Eastern Shore of Maryland. He was bass fishing with striper fishing with his dad one day, and his dad was using a fluke, and he was just, you know, fish on every cast. And Jake was like, man, he was fishing flies, and he just wasn't doing it. He's like, I need to make a fly that acts like that thing and like a fluke in the water. And the one thing about Jake's flies, really all good flies, everything that's on those flies and incorporated in the design of a fly is there for a reason. And there's nothing superfluous about Jake's roamer. You know, everything is there and everything is in its place for a specific reason. And I have a ton of respect for his tying, and I have a ton of respect for everybody's flies in that book.
The feather game changer.
Yeah.
Or the feather changer that they call it.
Right, so right.
They usually don't say game when they call it
the feather changer.
I heard it as feather changer.
Right. It's this feather game changer, you know.
Yeah.
Well, aesthetically, you know, speaking, that one in the book is beautiful. Brendan Rush is a phenomenal tire. He guides with us out of TCO Boiling Springs.
One of Blaine Chocolate's patterns.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, I've seen fish that trout, like the – there's some smaller ones. I use them, and like they're not real big. They're kind of, you know, like maybe 2-3 inches long. And
feather changers.
Yeah, and I've just seen fish trout react to those flies in a way they don't react to anything else. And we were just talking about the roamer, and it's a really good fly, and it definitely catches trout. But those game changers are, you'd be hard pressed to find a better fly to fish that eat other fish.
So, what would be the big difference between a game changer and a feather changer?
Well, it depends on the material. I mean, there's all kind. The game changer is a platform. It could be a hybrid changer. It could be a feather changer. It could be a finesse changer. So it's really just the materials that you're using to tie the fly.
So the changer, the game changer, is like the articulation.
That's the platform that the flies are tied on. Yeah.
Squirmy wormy.
Yeah. Yeah.
It made the book.
It did. You know, it's kind of funny because I was a little hesitant about that fly, but hey, you know what? It's in my box, man, and sometimes the struggle's real, and, you
the
know.
The struggle is real.
And
enter the squirmy worm.
And, you know, if you have a client that doesn't have a lot of fishing experience or the conditions are tough, you know, if you really, 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 really need a fish, the squirmy worm's a great fly, you know. I don't care. And I was talking to Matt Kowalchuk, who's the head guide of the Feathered Hook up in Coburn on Penn's Creek, and he and I were I was talking about the squirmy worm, and he said something to me, and it kind of made up my mind or whether or not I was going to put it in the book or not. He said, "Look," he said, "every angler that I look up to fishes worms." I said, "There you go.
There it is."
And he, you know, we're talking about people in Central PA like George Daniel. We're talking about a lot of really, really talented anglers, you know, and guides that do it for a living full time and are catching fish. And I'll tell you what, you can have really crappy conditions, muddy water on the Latorte Spring Run, and you can put that squirmy worm on, you might catch fish.
Hi, I'm Angela with Cross Current Insurance. I manage our popular guide and outfitters insurance program. I've fished with guides in the U.S. and abroad, so I know the risks you face on and off the water. Our guide program provides liability coverage for your clients, boats, gear, and more. Plus, we donate a portion of our profits to industry nonprofit organizations, and you get to vote for who our donation goes to. So, whether you are a new guide or have been guiding for many years, check us out at crosscurrentinsurance.com. Tight lines!
What would be the type of fishing you like to do, Eric? What type of fishing is like your passion?
I'm a head hunter. I hunt. I'm fishing dry flies. I'm hunting heads. I'm a bug guy. I'm chasing hatches. I'm looking for heads. I'm looking for the biggest fish I can catch on a dry fly.
So sure. You're going to fish a dry fly or a dry fly?
Yeah, pretty much. Pretty much.
As dry as and dry.
Right. Like I said, you know, I don't mean to quote Garak, you know, I'm not a purist, but I want to be one when I grow up, you know.
Yeah.
It's just, I don't know, it's just a thing. It's a defect, I guess. I don't know.
So, yeah, I would agree with you. Headhunting is my favorite style.
It's phenomenal. And we have some really good opportunities here in Pennsylvania to do that, to some really, really nice fish. You know, there's nothing wrong with throwing streamers for big brown trout. It's cool. I don't have a problem with Euro nymphing or anything. I don't have a problem with anything. Euro nymphing, a tight line system, super productive, you know. I like to cast a fly line, you know, and it's just a personal preference.
Like a target.
Yeah.
Having a target.
I want to hunt. I want to hunt a fish. I want to
see if you can fool it.
I want to stalk it. I want to know. Yeah, exactly. I want to know that I like fishing heavily pressured waters and like the upper Delaware system. They see a ton of flies, but you have a shot at some really nice fish on dry flies. And, you know, it's akin to fishing out west on rivers like the Henry's Fork, you know, again, heavily pressured, but man, you know, you have a shot at a 2-footer on a dry fly. I mean,
okay.
That's awesome.
Yeah. 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 Where would you go if either in Pennsylvania or outside of Pennsylvania, if you could go fishing for like 2 or 3 days, and where would you want to go?
What time of year is it?
Your choice. This is like your dream here. Well, there's no boundaries other than it's going to be like a 2 to 4 day trip.
Yeah.
It's going to be in Pennsylvania or outside of Pennsylvania. And it's going to be doing the type of stuff you like to do in the conditions you like to do
it. I think, you know, Penn's Creek has I have a soft spot in my heart for Penn's Creek. I have family that had property up there growing up, so I spent a lot of time up there. If I could go, and this is probably, I shouldn't be talking about this, but if I could go to Penn's Creek right after the green drakes are ending or winding down and the Drunellas start popping the big blue-wing olives during the day, I've had some pretty phenomenal fishing on that. If you get an overcast, drizzly day, beginning first week of June, those big olives, those fish love that bug, man. They love that bug. They're coming off the green drake, so they're still looking up. The people are gone until they hear this. And
we're not gonna.
I'm spot
them.
Burning. I am. So you know, I don't know. I think there or like the upper Delaware system, Hendrickson hatches are so fun in the springtime too. You know, those fish are stupid. They're just excited to see bugs. You know, and. Again, I'll go anywhere if I can find rising fish that you know, I don't care.
Well, for the record, I gave you the whole world to choose from. I mean, I just said inside of Pennsylvania or outside.
Well, if I'm going to talk about that, I'd go to the lower Henry's Fork during Golden Stones and Green Drakes, really. I mean, that fishing, when you hit it right, or brown drakes out there, I mean... I haven't fished out west a whole lot, but what I have fished and what I have experienced, nothing compares to that.
Idaho.
Yeah.
That would be your dream destination.
Yeah, I love it. I love it out there.
The lower Henry's Fork for the
Henry's
drakes.
Henry's Fork for the drakes and Golden Stones.
Yeah. Golden Stones, yeah. Me and Ty went right by it, I think. We went through Idaho, and we were up more to the Ketchum area, though.
Mm-hmm.
We weren't fishing. We were coming out of California fishing, going to... Montana fishing.
Right.
So we just wanted to do some sightseeing because
right.
Idaho is beautiful, and it was more beautiful than I thought. I mean, I knew it was beautiful, but it was much more spectacular than I thought.
Yeah, it really is. It's fun. And I feel at home. I feel comfortable there too on the Henry's Fork.
Why?
It's a big spring creek.
It is.
You know, it's a tailwater, but it's a big spring creek, you know, really. Lots of vegetation. Lots of fish that act like jerks. I'm not a big numbers guy. I don't care. I really don't care if I don't make a cast most days. You know, I just kind of want to catch them on my terms, I guess.
Hunt them and see, wait for them to come up.
Yep.
Back to the dry or dry.
Right, I guess.
So you're not a Euronympher?
No, not really. I mean, I can do it.
Yeah.
It's
not your first choice, though.
No.
Three questions, one question, three parts. We kind of talked about it a bit, but I'll get you another opportunity to say your favorite dry, your favorite streamer, and your favorite nymph.
Okay.
We'll start with the favorite dry.
My favorite dry.
It doesn't have to be in your book, but it can be.
Probably my favorite dry fly is my CDC loopling emerger.
That is in your book.
It is in my book.
Why is it your favorite dry?
Because it works wherever I go. I think it...
It's a caddis?
No, it's a mayfly imitation. It has basically an entire nymph on the rear end of the hook. It's tied on a Klinkhammer, Daiichi Klinkhammer hook, 1167 or whatever they are. And the rear end of the fly is basically, it has literally tails, abdomen, thorax, legs of a nymph, and then transitions into the emerging mayfly, contrasting colors. Again, it's all derivative. It's sort of a combination of Shank stall cups, loopling emerger, and that CDC bubble back thing that Rene Hara pioneered back in the 70s. His captive done, his bubble back caddis. For me, that fly does it everywhere. Super picky fish. I remember I was fishing the Friends of the Upper Delaware River one bug a number of years ago, and it was just an absolute horrible day. And I picked a dry fly, and I was going to fish that one. And I had three shots at three rising fish that day. The first two were basically identical at 21 inches, and I threw that Hendrickson version of that fly at those fish, and they had absolutely no hesitation in eating it. And I caught the other fish. It wasn't quite as big, but the only three fish I saw rising that day, and they ate that fish on the Henry's Fork. Doesn't matter where you go. That fly, it works.
So that's the one. All right. So good. That's an awesome. Thank you for sharing that. Your favorite streamer?
Favorite streamer. Probably Game Changer.
The Game Changer, just in various patterns and styles.
Yep.
It's not that old. You know, that's not like how old. When did Blaine Chocolate originally create the Game Changer?
Oh, I don't know. That's a good question. And it really hasn't been that within the last 10 years, right?
Yeah.
My favorite. You're going to ask me my favorite nymph?
I am. Your favorite nymph?
My crest bug.
The crest bug?
Yeah.
It's Pennsylvania.
I'm getting the thumbs up over here.
That's his favorite nymph.
The crest bug. Hands down, at least for us, you know, in Spring Creeks around here, I don't have anything that compares to that fly. And that all goes back to Ed Shank. You know, it's basically modified Ed Shank's crest bug. You know, I think it was in the early 70s in a Fly Fisherman article that it first came out. I tie mine a little differently. It's kind of a pain in the butt to tie. It's super effective, and I can sight fish. I like to sight fish it single fly to a feeding fish on those spring creeks, and you know, I've caught some really nice fish on it.
So you say feeding fish, you see this fish actively feeding on nymphs.
Yeah, it's kind of like bone fishing, really. You'll see this fish feeding on the bottom. The way crest bugs are, they handle it a couple different ways, but I've seen fish that'll go into the weed bed, root around in it, and just kind of glide back and sit there and wait for the crest bugs to just fall out, and they just gorge on them. I've seen trout follow muskrats through the weeds. The muskrats will be swimming through the weeds, knocking bugs all loose, and they just are munching on crest bugs as they get knocked out of the vegetation. Or they'll be on these sandy flats, and the crest bugs will be walking along the bottom, and since their dorsal eventually flattened, a little current will grab them by the knock them over, and they'll tumble, and then they'll reposition themselves or get their footing, and then they'll kind of crawl across, and you know, those fish will just pounce on them. And I'm not talking, you know, little fish. I'm talking 4-6 pound fish.
Wow.
Yeah. So
that was super fun, Eric.
Yeah, nice. It's fun.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing all that cool stuff with us. Do you have a website for your guiding?
I do. It's www.riseforumsflyfishing.com. Also, I guide with Relentless Fly Fishing out of the TCO shop in Boiling Springs with Jake Vilwak and the rest of the crew there. You know, we have a good time. It's a great place to be. It's a great people to work with. Tom Baltz guides with us. You know, Jake, like I said, it's been a really great experience the last 5 or so years since TCO bought the shop in Boiling Springs. It's been fun. It's been a lot of fun.
Can folks buy your book on your website?
They can contact me individually, and I can get the book to them. I don't have the ability to pay for stuff. I'm not a webmaster.
So they can send you an email. They can order
it. Yeah, and I'll put it in the mail for them. I, you know, can Venmo or that kind of thing.
That's so cool. Favorite flies for Pennsylvania, 50 essential patterns from local experts. Eric, it's been an absolute blast to have you on the podcast.
Yeah, thank you very much. I really appreciate you giving me the time.
You've been listening to Fly Fishing Journeys with your host, Rob Giannino. To be notified of new episodes, subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, or Google Podcasts. You can follow us on YouTube, Facebook, and Instagram. For past episodes, check out flyfishingjourneys.com. Fly fishing is a journey, and we're glad you're on this journey with us.